for an even better way to listen to Football Weekly at home, at work or on the go, head to soundcloud.com/Guardian Football Weekly or download the SoundCloud app for Android and iPhone.
Hello and welcome to Football Weekly Extra. The show that I've discovered this week is pretty much the same as Football Weekly, but has a different name. A cunning sleight of hand that's kept us all on the back foot for many years. I'm still not James Richardson, but he'll be back on Monday, so you can all get your fix. For today, though, it is me, Dave Farrar, again, and we'll be discussing Champions League oops for both Arsenal and Barcelona, a good first half between Galatasaray and Schalke, and we'll take a look ahead to a romantic weekend. Bradford go to Wembley, Bex might make his debut, San Siro will be a riot of colour, and Fulham play Stoke. To discuss all of that in a seemingly impossible 43 minutes, I'm joined by a suitably smug Raphael Honigstein, who's going to tell us that German football is great, a possibly chastened Barry Glendening after his Galatasaray tip, and a nervous Jacob Steinberg, who's only just realised he'll be required to give his opinion on Belinda Carlisle's fancy ability or otherwise at some point today. But we have to start, of course, with Arsenal, which means we have to start with Bayern, which means we have to start with you, Raffy. Was that very much as expected? Because from an English journalistic point of view, from people who don't watch the Bundesliga a lot, Bayern, it would seem, are the second coming.
Expected maybe in terms of Bayern having a very good performance and a decent result, but unexpected because I thought Arsenal might pose them more problems. The good spell that Arsenal had for the first 5 minutes and then another 25 minutes or so in the second half, I thought they'd have more of that, more pressure on Bayern. And also Bayern did have some weakness. You know, that was there to be exploited, and I think Arsenal missed a trick. They really missed a trick by sitting very deep, and especially after going 2-0 up within 20 minutes, I think Bayern sort of waited for them now to come, and they never came before the break. And then, of course, like Jupinka said, it looked incredibly easy because they were passing the ball around while Arsenal were still waiting, sitting deep. And I don't know if that was the intention or if there was any real intention or real game plan from Arsene Wenger, but it obviously didn't work.
Jacob, Arsenal looked a little scared of Bayern, didn't they?
Well, they often do in these big games. You think back to the Manchester City game where they came out, rabbits in the headlights, and they just, typical Arsenal, they started playing when the game was already lost. I think the tie was basically over when it was 2-0 after 20 minutes. Couldn't really see Arsenal getting back into it. Even if they got it back into the game on the night, there's no way they were going to overcome those two away goals. And it's just the defending and the organisation within the side is so poor. If you compare them to Milan, who I don't think have maybe the best 11 players in the team, the organisation was so much better. And Arsenal, you question the coaching, the mentality of some of the players. Some seem to be the work rate or the togetherness within the side. And it was just very, very easy for Bayern. It didn't feel like a remotely a game between two top sides.
And Barry, what was your take on, we sort of talked about it, didn't we, on Monday, and it all pretty much panned out as we'd expected.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Arsenal were beaten before they even went out on the pitch. Men against boys has been talked about in relation to this game, and even as they lined up in the tunnel, Bayern's player just looked more relaxed, they looked bigger, they exuded confidence and you know, they just looked stronger and fitter. And you could sort of see some Arsenal players looking at them slightly in awe, almost, which is kind of worrying. And Arsenal, there's no shame to losing against Bayern Munich, but losing because you're making the same old mistakes and must be infuriating for Arsenal players. And as Jacob said, and I know it's a drum Rafa's banged for a while, at some point you're going to have to point the finger at Wenger and say perhaps his coaching methods aren't up to scratch, because he has good players, but they're making terrible, terrible mistakes. And it's kind of ironic, actually, that one of the worst players in Arsenal's team, or possibly the worst of many bad performances among the Arsenal ranks, and came from a player who was offloaded by Bayern.
Yeah, in the shape of Lucas Podolski, and another poor performance from another German as well, Rafi.
Yeah, Mertesacker didn't have a great game, although I think it's wrong to point the finger necessarily at individual mistakes, especially at the back. I mean, we've had it now for 8 years. You know, people walking past the press box at the Emirates and screaming about better defenders being bought, and, you know, why doesn't he go out and buy better defenders? But you also have to coach your defenders and your midfielders to protect your defenders and your strikers to come back and not just start standing around at the halfway line. And I think it's very, very easy to play that game to say, you know, we need investment, we need better players. The interesting thing is that some of the Bayern officials were sort of almost being, and not in a patronising way, but almost being kind of feeling sympathy for Wenger and for Arsenal, because when they met in 2001 and again in 2005, they said, you know, this is not the same team. This is not the same club that we were up against in those years. You know, that at the time it was Henri, it was Beckham. Then 4 years later, this was the tail end of the Invincibles. Vieira still on the pitch. You know, the likes of Reyes, etc. This is not the same quality, but it's the same manager. And you wonder, you know, what has happened? Where's that decline come from? Because it certainly didn't come overnight.
It's very strange, isn't it? That they, although they sell these top players all the time, it used to be that Wenger would sell someone like Anelka or Overmars, and they were getting a brilliant player like Omri or Pires would come in. And now when they sell, you know, Van Persie, Nasri, he brings in someone like Giroud, who's a good player but not ready. It's wasted money on people like Jovinho. You wonder what's happened to Wenger in the transfer market as well. If you buy these players, then you are going to end up just challenging around for fourth place, fifth, sixth in the end.
Although that's a very reactive view, isn't it, of Arsenal in the transfer market? I mean, was Henri and was Pires, were they top players when they joined Arsenal? I think Arsenal made them better players.
He did make them better players, but also they have won World Cups and European Championships by the time they came to Arsenal. There was obvious quality there, and you don't really see where people like Podolski or Giroud are going to improve at the moment.
I mean, one interesting thing about both teams, if you compare in terms of transfers, I always think what Wenger used to do is sign the players that he knew would fit into the club and would fit into the system that they play. And I think Bayern do that particularly well. Dante would be a very good example of someone who wasn't necessarily wanted by every single big club in the world, but Bayern knew would fit them and would be a really good fit. Has Wenger, Barry, do you think, lost the knack of doing that a little bit? Is he just almost a bit more scattergun than he used to be? It feels that way.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, over the last few years when they weren't winning titles, there was a lot of pressure on him to change his plan, to have a more physical centre-forward, to have different centre-backs, and he's done that to a certain extent. You know, somebody like Mertesacker and Giroud perhaps wouldn't have fit the system, the old Wenger system in the past, but I think it's a little bit too easy to say, you know, we're changing our plan by now having different players. You think, where's the cohesion gone? Where's the kind of uniform identity on the pitch from this team? What is it they're actually playing? I mean, there used to be a brilliant counter-attacking side. The best Arsene Wenger team was a team that would hit you when the other team had the corner. That was always where they were strongest. Henri would get to the opposition box within the space of 3 or 4 seconds, and nobody at that time could deal with that first passing and that movement. But that's long gone, and now you wonder, you know, what is the game plan? 3 or 4 years ago, they looked like they're kind of a Barcelona, always keeping the ball, never doing anything with it. Now that's changed again. They're not playing that way anymore, but I'd be very hard-pressed to tell you what they're actually playing.
And yet, amidst all of this, the stories, Barry, today are very much that there'll be £70 million to spend in the summer, that Wenger's job is more than safe, and that there won't be a change. So is that the right thing, do you think?
Well, Arsenal's fans are always told that there'll be loads of money to spend around this time of year when their season tickets are up for renewal and the club want them to spend money renewing those tickets. Whether or not, we all know the money is there to be spent, whether it will be spent or not remains to be seen, but a lot of people seem to think that the club are making money, the businessmen running the club just want to continue making money, and they're not particularly interested in winning trophies. So I'm not privy to the workings or machinations of the Arsenal boardroom, so I don't know which is true.
Yeah, it seems though, Rafi, that Wenger will do for them, doesn't it? Are you surprised by the normally the stories that would come out? I'll ask Jake about this in a second as well. Normally, the stories after a result like that and after the Blackburn game as well would very much be Wenger faces sack. You know, other coaches might even be sacked after a result like that. But none of that is coming out of Arsenal. In a way, you can praise them for the sense of stability they're bringing to things, can't you?
Yeah, there's definitely a strong stability. And the problem is, I think, for some Arsenal fans, it's almost too strong because it seems to be almost independent of the results. Yes, of course, they are achieving their declared aim. They're winning the imaginary trophy of fourth spot. He's been winning it for a long, long time, at least fourth spot. But fans want a bit more. They don't understand why you can't challenge for, let's say, cup competitions at the same time as you are trying to get into the Champions League. And you wonder, you really wonder, and I was wondering this morning, what's happened to Wenger over the last few years? And because he's not really that coach anymore and that manager that we all used to rave about, or certainly I was a few years ago. And it reminded me of a conversation I had in my former life when I was writing about music. I was talking to D'Angelo about the reasons for Prince's decline in the late 80s and 90s, where he really completely went off the boil almost overnight. And my fear was that Prince was inhibited and felt threatened by the emergence of hip-hop and the sampling and all these things that before that he was, with his instrumental ability, been able to sort of bring these things forward, but now younger guys were doing it in a better way with sampling, and he didn't know what to do with it. And D'Angelo said no. He said it's something that happens to almost everyone who's at the top for a very long time. He said they hold themselves up. Prince hold himself up in Paisley Park, never really went out anymore, never really listened to what's going on about him. So it was always just became very isolated and lost the track, basically. I think if you relate those two back ideas to football, you could say both of these theories could be true. I think Wenger's not been able to quite get to the point where the younger coaches and the pressing game that's emerged has happened. He seems unable to replicate that. And at the same time, you wonder, you know, has he been by himself for too long without any real outside input from sporting directors, from people above him, next to him? I think he's just a little bit lost in his own thoughts.
The emergence of sort of posh boy folk bands like Mumford and Sons have also contributed to his decline, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, as Marcus Mumford has risen, so Wenger has declined. And I thought that Rafa was going to bring in, you know, Falco, for example. Austrian, I know, but, you know, after the heady heights of Three and Rock Me Amadeus and Genie and all those songs, of course, just fell away with his second album. But someone like Herbert Grönemeyer, for example, able to just continue at this level of success. Herbert Grönemeyer, very much Sir Alex Ferguson. But, Jacob, Arsenal at home to Aston Villa this weekend. Now, I think what you're supposed to say, cliche-wise here, is he wouldn't necessarily have handpicked that opposition because they're not playing as badly as their results would suggest, and they'll have watched the Blackburn game.
I saw Aston Villa's last game, and although they beat West Ham, they were quite poor in it. They're not a good side. I think that's quite a good game for Arsenal at home. Villa are very poor defensively. They've got possibly Benteke, who could ruffle a few feathers in that Arsenal defence, but you would be very, very surprised if Arsenal don't win that game, even though they're playing so poorly in these last couple of weeks.
But don't you feel in a way that they'd rather be playing a big game this weekend, Barry? I'm not so sure I agree with you. I mean, I'm just asking the questions. You're very much the pundit, but Villa might just fancy that game.
I mean, they will. I would expect Arsenal to beat them, and then I would expect assorted Arsenal players to come out and say that, you know, we've made up for Tuesday's disappointment, because footballers always do that. It's like John Terry famously scoring in some nothing game against the United States, and that makes up for, or you know, whatever reverse it was he was talking about, I can't remember. But Arsenal's players probably would prefer to have the weekend off altogether and don't really mind who they're playing.
Yeah, well, to use Rafi's wonderful analogy to just round things off before we go on to Sid Lowe, Arsenal fans wish they could party like it's somewhere near 1999.
It's a sign of the times that they can't.
Well, we move on from one Champions League result that wasn't really a surprise to one that most certainly was. Rafi, Milan against Barcelona, and no one saw that coming.
No, certainly not Barcelona, who turned up, I think, maybe in a false, with a false sense of security, perhaps after watching Bayern dominate Arsenal away from home to that extent. Maybe they thought, you know, if we turn on our passing game, that's going to be a similar outcome. And of course, Milan made it really, really difficult for them, pressed, but also really intelligently, sometimes pressed high up, then sometimes dropped really deep. And they had variation, and they had an intelligence going forward. They weren't just hoofing it up because there was no really up there to hold the ball up. They don't really have that play anymore. But playing sort of intelligent little triangles and really maximising sort of the effect every time they went forward. They looked more threatening than Barcelona, who were around the box all the time, and I think only had like 3 or 4 touches in the box the whole game. So I thought it was a brilliant performance from Milan, really well deserved, and Barcelona, if they're not careful, they're out.
Yeah, and all the more surprising given that Milan, of course, don't have their best player, the man who's lifted them in recent weeks, Balotelli, who was there celebrating on the sidelines, Jacob. But, I mean, Abbiati, I think, made one save, and it wasn't a particularly difficult save in the game.
Xavi, didn't he, in the first half? And I never, although they had all that possession, it was, Arsene Wenger criticised their Barcelona a few years ago for sterile domination, and it was a bit of a weird comment then because they had just stuffed Arsenal. But last night, that's what it was. I never really thought they were going to score. They were very, very poor going forward, and when they are that, when they do have that trouble going forward, they leave themselves vulnerable at the back because they don't have a defence that leaves you confident they can keep that clean sheet. And I just wonder if they have possibly messed up what was the perhaps the greatest side of all time in 2011. They've compromised, I think, in Iniesta with Fabregas in the side. I don't think he's the same player when he plays out on the left. Sanchez hasn't really done a lot since coming in, and I want to see David Villa back in that team. I know he was out last night with the kidney stones, but there wasn't the speed of the passing. There weren't enough options around the box. It was much easier to crowd out Messi, who didn't really look like he knew what he was meant to be doing last night. One of the poorest games I've ever seen him have. I don't know if he even had a shot throughout the game. Certainly not one that was on target. And you fear for them now in the second leg. Unless they perhaps bring back in David Villa, you're wondering where the goals are coming from if it's not from Messi at the moment.
We'll get Barry's views in just a second, but let's catch up with Sid Lowe, who sort of predicted Barcelona's demise, although not particularly on this given night. I caught up with him earlier. Well, Sid, you sort of called it, Milan beating Barcelona by 2-0, but you didn't really, did you? Because you didn't expect it to be Milan, who were the ones who would put Barca to the sword.
No, I mean, as I said on the poll on Monday, I don't know enough about Milan to properly give a judgment on them. But certainly, this was a shock result. There's no two ways about it. Nobody expected this, and I didn't expect it either. But there were some of the warning signs there with Barcelona. Some of the sluggishness in their play, the fact that they concede goals rather too easily, the fact that they can dominate possession, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have the better chances. And I think one of the most striking things about last night is not just that Barcelona lost, but that there really couldn't be any complaints about it.
Yeah, Abbiati didn't really have a save to make. I mean, he's been quoted as saying how surprised he was. I think, in fairness as well, you don't watch enough of Milan. I probably do, and I'm just as shocked as you. Do you think it's turned roundable at the Camp Nou? Can Barca do it? I mean, the problem is, of course, if Milan score, Barcelona are going to need to score 4. That's always a problem with a 2-0 home win, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Raúl last night, of course, Barcelona's assistant coach, the guy who's currently in charge while Tito Villanova is away, said he was absolutely convinced not just that they could turn it around, but that they would turn it around. But the way he said it actually lacked the conviction that he claimed to have. It was quite deadpan, although that's partly just a natural product of the way he delivers virtually all of the things he says. I think, of course, it's possible. There's no doubt that it's possible. I expect them to encounter a Milan side who do much the same thing, who try and deny them space. But as Raúl said, and he made an interesting point, it will be at home with the fans on a different pitch where the ball will travel more quickly. And I think that also makes an interesting point when he talks about the need for them to travel, move the ball quickly, circulate it much, much faster. It's an illustration of him saying, not saying, we lack a plan B. It's more him saying we need to get the plan A right. We need to do it better. We need to do the things we do well and do them well. And I think it is turnaroundable, but I think it's going to be very, very difficult indeed for precisely the reason you say. If Milan get a goal, and all the way through the game, Barcelona will be nervy about that. If Milan get a goal, well, then it's very, very hard to see how they can get through.
Isn't the pitch thing a gigantic red herring? I say that because surely every Spanish pitch in La Liga isn't better than the pitch at San Siro. I accept it's not perfect, but for example, a fortnight ago, I watched Inter beat Chievo on that selfsame pitch at San Siro, and Chievo played some fantastic passing football in the second half, and I don't think their central midfielder, Luca Rigoni, would necessarily get into the Barca side.
No, and actually, for what it's worth, in the first half at least yesterday, I thought there were some passages of play from Barcelona which were exceptional in terms of the ability to move the ball around. And there were a couple of times where they worked themselves out of corners to keep possession, which were really quite impressive. But, of course, the problem they had was that they were working the ball really well to get themselves away from challenges and to maintain possession rather than to get themselves into space and create chances. I think it makes a bit of a difference. But, of course, you know, without being down the pitch, without trying it out, it's very difficult to judge. Perhaps the best way of doing this is to give you an answer from a player who maybe wouldn't necessarily support Barcelona in this kind of thing, and that's Álvaro Arbeloa. But, of course, the context is the Spanish national team when he's playing with Barcelona players. I asked him about this at the European Championships because, if you remember, Spain complained about the pitches in Poland as well. They said the grass was dry and it was quite long. And Arbeloa at that stage said it really genuinely does make a difference. If you've got a game that's based precisely on that and you're used to the ball travelling quickly and that you know you're going to come up against a closed defence and therefore the only way around them is to move it very, very fast so they can't react, to switch the play quickly between players, he said it genuinely does make a difference. It may feel like a small issue, but it's quite a big one. It's very, very difficult to judge. I'm sure it made a difference of sorts, but I don't think it's an excuse. And it was interesting listening to PK last night. He said, look, referees, pitches, talk about whatever you want, but that's just not an excuse. We knew what we were going to be faced with. We made mistakes that are our fault, and we have to analyse them. And I think this is part of the thing, is that Barcelona have got some things wrong for quite a long time now. And, you know, relatively minor things, but minor things that in a big game make a difference.
And Barry, a word from you about this. Do you think it had anything to do with Barcelona's kits, which must be one of the biggest disgraces I've ever seen in European football, I think?
It's hideous and just very unfortunate that such a grand old club are resorting to having their players run around like little soleros with legs. It's an abomination. Yeah, I find it quite sad.
Who would have looked at that in the design process and gone, yeah, that's the one. I think we're on to a winner here, lads. We've done it.
I mean, I've often thought, you know, if I could just be a professional footballer for one game, I'd want to play for Barcelona, pull on that shirt, but not if they're away from home.
They have a history of poor away kits, though, Barcelona. I don't know what it's what the reason for that is, but Ruud Gullit tweeted, or perhaps he had someone tweet for him, because I've seen him actually using an assistant for these minor tasks in TV studios. He said, this is worse than a 1988 Dutch kit. And that really is some kind of indictment.
That is, apparently it's modelled on a Catalan sunset. And I just want to go back to something that Ruud Gullit has an assistant who tweets for him when he's doing live TV broadcasts.
She's his assistant, full stop.
Right.
And he gets her to tweet because...
Because he can't be bothered?
He dictates tweets, does he?
Yes.
Okay, there's something that shines a light. Great moment, I thought, on Sky's coverage for any boxing fans who may be listening. I don't know if anyone saw this, but when Ruud Gullit said it was like this fight that Muhammad Ali had, you know the one, I can't remember the opponent, and Jamie Redknapp said Buster Douglas, and of course we all remember Muhammad Ali against Buster Douglas, that great night of championship boxing. You clearly heard that, Jacob.
That was brilliant, yeah.
He did eventually say rope-a-dope, so he managed to get out of it.
Why didn't
he
mention Club Alang?
Club Alang, yeah, Club Alang would be another one, absolutely. I've got some messages about our continuing discussion about whether there is a place on Earth called Heaven. This, of course, is a result of Sid Lowe's obsession, I have to call it that, with Belinda Carlisle. First of all, though, before
I would argue it's your obsession.
Would you?
Belinda Carlisle.
You're the one who admitted that you had a crush on her.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I admitted it.
That's true, and you're suggesting I'm repressed about Belinda Carlisle. Rafi, your thoughts on Belinda Carlisle from an artistic point of view?
I'm more of a Bengals man, Susanna Hoffs.
Susanna Hoffs, yes. Did it for That's you as more, a as a young man.
Yeah.
Okay, right. And Jacob?
She didn't, unfortunately.
Jacob, this is stopping soon.
I'm afraid I don't really have any opinion either way on Belinda Carlisle.
Really?
I can't join in on this obsession.
Are you too young?
Possibly, yeah.
That's really strikes a dagger in the heart of the rest of us. In terms of whether there is a heaven on a place on Earth, heaven is a place on Earth. Cold Coffee has been in touch to say Devon is a place on Earth, which I quite liked. In Crises, according to Google Maps, the closest thing called heaven on Earth is Heavener in Oklahoma, but there is a place named Utopia in Texas, and a Hereafter Lane in Michigan. And Philippa B., who's down in Montpellier, you'd know about this, Raf, he said there's a Himmelstadt in Germany, which means heaven town. So I think we've probably drawn a line under the Belinda Carlisle, which has already gone on for far too long. So seamlessly from Belinda Carlisle to Galatasaray against Schalke. Barry, you first of all, because we both, in fairness, thought that they were, you know, a stonking bet, and they may yet be if they go and get a 2-2 draw away from home or win there. But that was a little bit of a surprise, wasn't it?
I think it was a big surprise. I'm not going to claim to know a huge amount about either side, but from what I've heard from Raphael in particular, you know, Schalke were, there's no doubt, were in disarray. They in crisis, as we like to say. But they played very well last night and seemed to surprise a lot of people. Certainly surprised Galatasaray, I think. Having said that, I still think Galatasaray should have won the game. They missed at least two, if not three, chances they should have put away. And while I wouldn't be hugely confident they will proceed at Schalke's expense, because the German side obviously have the advantage playing at home in the second leg, I am still hopeful my bet will come in. But certainly not as hopeful or as confident as I was this time yesterday.
Yeah, Shaka Hislop tweeted, of course his real name is Neil, which I always find entertaining. Shaka Hislop tweeted that if you want to see a cracking 90 minutes of football after the Barcelona game, just watch the first half twice. And apparently that was the case, Rafi.
The first half was pretty good. I didn't see all of it because I was mostly watching Milan, but it was very open on a very poor pitch, which was interesting because you usually think, you know, that's going to make for a really terrible, terrible game. But there were lots of chances either side, and Huntelaar missed an absolute sitter. I don't know if you saw this, Barry, but he basically missed from about 30 centimetres out, and there was another guy behind him queuing up, Matip, so they both could have scored and neither of them did. And it was a great, great result for Schalke because they were in disarray. They were terrible. But I think after, perhaps you should have asked me again after Saturday, because that was the first sign, the 2-2 away to Mainz, that maybe they're just sort of beginning to find their feet again. Before that, it was just one defeat after another and just terrible, terrible football. And now you'd fancy them to go through.
Yeah, Schalke may be surprising quite a lot of people. I wonder, are they going to be one of these teams that just stumbles and stutters and manage to find themselves in the semi-final?
That's what they did,
yeah.
Of course, in 2011, I think, when they somehow were up against Man United and, of course, were completely destroyed over two legs. But it's not inconceivable.
Strongest tournaments in years, though, I think. There's a lot of very, very good teams, so maybe not the opportunity for a side like Schalke to bumble their way through. Chelsea style.
Yeah, well, a lot of very good teams, but some of them under pressure, and United and Real Madrid, two of them taking each other out and things like that. It could be, as we discussed on Monday, a little avenue for a strange finalist, at least, in the Champions League. We should just mention, we're going to talk the Capital One Cup final and the Premier League in part three, but we should mention, because we talked a little bit about Milan, the Milan derby is this weekend at the same time as PSG against Marseille on Sunday night, which is going to be really thrilling, Rafi, both of those. I mean, it looks like Beckham will be on the bench. It looks like, of course, he may make his debut, depending on how the game's going. Is that as significant a moment in European football as it will be made to appear?
No. No, it's not. It's not significant for European football. It's significant for him, and it's a really interesting story that, you know, they bring him in after Ancelotti basically saying, we don't need him, I don't want him, yet there he is. You know, you'd be interested to see what he can do if he gets an opportunity to be on the pitch. PSG are a very decent side and, you know, have a good chance of getting into the quarterfinals and maybe causing the more established sides one or two problems. And I think in that respect, it's interesting that he is still there and possibly at that level, possibly in a Champions League quarterfinal, maybe semi-final.
Yeah, it could be fascinating. And it's Beckham against Barton, of course. It's how it's going to be billed, isn't it, Barry?
Well, that's certainly how it'll be billed over here. Barton has said on Twitter that, you know, Beckham is, whereas he would have been concerned about facing Beckham many years ago, it's no longer the case. And Barton is probably the better player at this stage. Just he's younger, he's fitter, probably hungrier, although that could be argued that's not the case. But yeah, it'll be interesting. It's an interesting sort of sideshow, but I don't think too many people over here get very excited about the French league anyway. But PSG would probably be the favourites, and Beckham will probably end up scoring a winner with a free kick or something, because he has a habit of doing that.
Obviously, myself and Rafi would argue completely with your comment about the French league, given that we both work regularly for the channel that shows it in this country.
No, I'm not doing it down, although I regularly do. But people in England just tend not to be interested in French football.
No, it's a valid point, certainly. Jacob, what's your sort of ideas about PSG against Marseille? Is it a game that captures your imagination? You could just say no if you want.
No, which one's on TV? I'd want to watch the Milan derby.
I can tell you they both are.
They're both
on ESPN. The Milan derby's on ESPN and the PSG Marseille's on ESPN Classic.
Oh, really?
So you have an option to watch.
I'll be watching the Milan derby.
To watch either game. Okay, well, that's your choice. And why will you be watching the Milan derby? Riot of colour, as I said.
Yeah, I like that game. It's very loud.
Yeah, nice loud game. And Milan have to be favourites, don't they, after what happened in the week, particularly with Super Mario to come back?
Oh yeah, that'll be good, won't it? And I saw that game against Fiorentina on Sunday, and they look like a bit of a rabble at the moment, Inter. So the way Milan played on Wednesday night, you'd think they were going to win that.
Would you say their exertions, mental and physical, will perhaps go against them in the game against Inter?
You know, Inter have this game tonight as well, don't they? So no one likes playing in the Europa League.
Although it's a low-pressure game because they're already leading against Cluj, aren't they? But I think the point you make, Barry, is really interesting because normally you would say yes, wouldn't you? You'd say, you know, Milan have had this hugely emotional victory, but I think the difference this time is that you've got their top player who is fresh and he can come back into the side to lift them. And Inter, as you point out, Jacob, have been pretty dreadful lately. So,
well, there is that, yeah. I just think the sheer concentration needed to play like they did against Barcelona takes a lot more out of a side than perhaps you might think.
It'd be interesting atmosphere as well, Rafi, wouldn't it? Because it's Inter's home game, and of course it's Balotelli playing for Milan against Inter. You know, is there anything that ranks alongside that in German football? You instantly think of Figo, don't you, and things like that in the Barca-Real rivalry, but anything you can think of?
The Milan derby is unique in that respect because players regularly move from one club to the other, and they usually, or very often, tend to play a lot better for Milan when they go from Inter to Milan, historically. I think Cassano might be the exception of the last, you know, 15, 20 years, but Inter famously sold all these wonderful players and Milan have picked them up and can't quite believe the luck. And, you know, Balotelli is a little bit different because he went via City, but I think it was always well known that he was actually a closet Milan fan. So I don't think the reception will be all that welcome.
He was actually smiling last night, Balotelli, wasn't he?
He was laughing. He wasn't just smiling. He was jumping up around.
First time you've seen that for a while.
Just a final word on these sort of hatred derbies and whatever. PSG Marseille, going back to that, produced my favourite banner I think I've ever seen at a football match, or one of anyway. When do you remember Frédéric Dehu and the player who played for Barcelona, the big sort of solid French centre-half? He and a player called Fabrice Fiorez, who was smaller with sort of long hair. Dehu left PSG to go to Marseille. Fiorez went very controversially 3 weeks later. So the PSG fans were obviously in this state of absolute hatred towards them. And there was a banner up before PSG Marseille and it said, Dehu Fiorez, first the husband leaves, then the wife, which I quite liked. It was making allusions that the two of them didn't maybe appreciate. Anyway, Capital One Cup and Premier League to come in a second.
This week on The Guardian Audio Edition, Tracy Thorne, the accidental pop star. Churches step in to fill the gap left by welfare cuts. And in the book review, we consider Frankenstein by Mary Shelley and Wendy Moore's How to Create the Perfect Wife. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/Guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
Right, we're going to talk Capital One Cup final and the wonderful romance of Bradford and everything in a second. But a quick look at the championship. Chunt89, who apparently is a, careful how you say that, sporadic listener this season. But he said, has anyone talked about Cardiff's utter domination of the championship this year? But of course, he says, when the pod does discuss, it'll trigger the collapse. And so it did, apparently. They went down 2-0 at home to Brighton. They've still got a 5-point lead at the top, but Hull are closing in after they beat Blackburn. But in the championship, Paul Ince, Barry, his first game in charge of Blackpool, lost away to Leeds. And he becomes the latest in a long line of fathers who are having to manage sons, doesn't he?
Yeah, this is a big job for Paul Ince, and you know, could possibly be his last if it doesn't go well. He's been out of work for a long time, and it will be very interesting to see how he gets on.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, Rafi, because you get to a point as a manager where I think a good a good job that you do as a manager buys you a couple more jobs down the line, but he's run out of those, hasn't he? And as Barry says, he needs to succeed here, or at least give the perception of having succeeded.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think you can sort of do a 3 or 4 wrong moves and people still say, but he, you know, he did this and that in the late 90s. But eventually people just think you're a busted flush, and I think they're getting to that stage.
Yeah. What do you make of Ince as a manager, Jacob? Is he someone who can scale the heights? Or
Not a lot at the moment. There's not a lot of evidence to back him up, but... Blackpool have some all right players. They've really struggled this season with Holloway going, and they've lost a lot of players, and they've struggled to replicate the form of last season when they got to the playoff final. And I think for him, just making sure they don't end up in a relegation fight would be a success, and then he can push on next season. He probably won't have his son for too much longer, though, because he's going to be a brilliant player.
Yeah, he's interesting, everyone. The other managerial interest, of course, in the lower leagues is Di Canio, who seems to have walked out in a strop at Swindon. And you're a West Ham fan, Jacob. What do you make of his role in English football now? Has he done that because he ultimately wants your club?
I think it's almost inevitable he'll end up at West Ham at some point, but I hope it's not in the summer. There's a lot of stories at the moment about Allardyce, who's out of contract in the summer, and the club have said they're not going to discuss a new deal until the side is safe from relegation this season. It's very interesting. There's a few whispers here and there that some people in the club don't want him, Allardyce, and now fans, because Di Canio is available, want Di Canio to be given the job. But he would worry about the way that he's gone out, left Swindon at the first sign of trouble, and whether as well, although he's done a very good job there, they're top of League One, whether some of the stunts that he's pulled how that would go down with the Premier League players, you know, taking off the goalkeeper after 20 minutes, calling the players donkeys, and the fight he had with Wes Fotheringham on the touchline. You couldn't really see him getting away with that if he tried that with people like Andy Carroll.
I mean, we're supposed to say, aren't we, things like, he makes the game a more interesting place to be, and so on and so forth, and I'm sure a lot of people will be saying West Ham fans can't wait for him to be their manager. Do you think either of those things are true? Does he make the game too interesting at times, you think, and too much about him?
When West Ham went down in 2003, he made it very much about him. He had a big falling out with Glenn Rhoda when he got taken off during a game against West Brom, which they actually won. He got taken off just after half-time and had a huge row with Rhoda on the touchline, and it wasn't the first time he'd done that. He didn't play again for another 2 or 3 months. And then when he came back, he scored in his last game against Chelsea, but... You know, that there is a bit of romance. You only remember the good stuff with Di Canio. I don't know how much you can trust him. Whether that ego can be tamed.
Okay, we shall leave it there. Capital One Cup final now, Barry. The papers will be full of the romance. I'm sure the Guardian will be as well. Of Bradford, 71 places lower than Swansea, already beaten 3 Premier League clubs, and the question will be, can they do it? What do you make of the day? Is it a special day in this time of money in football? Is this romantic story one that we should all buy into?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it anyway. I can't wait. I suspect figures will be down, TV viewing figures, but I'll certainly be tuning in with interest, and I think there's every chance Bradford could win it. Swansea concede more goals than any other team in the Premier League from set pieces. Bradford are well equipped to exploit that weakness. In Gary Jones, he gives good dead ball, and they've tall players like James Hansen, Andrew Davis, Rory McArdle, and Karl McHugh, who can all, you know, they're all good in the air, big guys and good in the air. And, you know, it's not that Bradford are relying on those kind of Neanderthal, for want of a better word, tactics exclusively. They're very well schooled, they're fit as fiddles, possibly because they've played so many games this season. They've played a phenomenal number of games this season compared to everyone else. And, they play the game at a very, very high tempo. So they'll close down Swansea's, you know, superior players, won't give them much time on the ball, I suspect. And I certainly wouldn't bet against Bradford.
Yeah, they've actually, in 2013, you know, got just 5 points from 7 games in the league. They've lost to Wimbledon, Gillingham, Oxford and Barnet so far, and yet they've done this amazing thing. And they've won their last 9 penalty shootouts as well, Bradford, which might be a stat worth remembering come Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, well, that's an astonishing stat. You know, and it can't just be luck, you know. Well, it isn't luck. Penalty shootouts are often described as lotteries. They aren't. And to win 9 in succession is a phenomenal achievement.
Is it going to be something that's going to cross your consciousness, Jacob? Are you going to watch it?
Well, yeah, definitely I'll be watching that. It's going to be a great occasion, I think. And Swansea are probably in a better place, though, than any of the Premier League sides that that Bradford have beaten on the way to getting to the final. Good team, Swansea. 8th, 7th in the league, and although they had that blip against Liverpool on the weekend, you just wonder how they'll cope against that passing style and people like Michu up front. And when they beat Arsenal, it was Arsenal really just collapsed in that game, didn't they? And Villa again, a bit of a joke at the time. So I would err on the side of a Swansea win.
Does this make any waves at all in the German media, stories like this? Because it does sort of the other way, doesn't it? I mean, we mentioned on Monday the French Cup. Sometimes Calais was a story here. I mean, not a vast one. And you've had a couple in Germany, haven't you, of smaller teams making the final. And does this get airtime?
It does, because of Jerry Tremel in goal, of course. I think almost from a German perspective, the story is really Swansea being the romantic sort of outsider, because they've never won any real proper trophy before. And it's almost as if they're a little bit unlucky that they're coming up against even smaller minnows, that everyone's looking at them, looking at Bradford. But, you know, their achievement is really tremendous, and the way they were celebrating against Chelsea just showed, you know, just how big it was for the club. And if they were to win it, I think it would be absolutely amazing for them. And I think it's also a team that, as a neutral, you can just look at and say, yeah, be great if they won something, because they deserve it. They play really nice football. It's very good to look at. In Laudrup, they have a guy who's bought really smart, and the club is run in a very, very smart way. And I think if they were to win something, which always validates ways of doing things, I think one or two clubs or Premier League bosses might actually look at a system where, you know, they brought in Laudrup to be the coach, not necessarily to run the whole club like other clubs have. And I think that's very smart, because Swansea are, you know, one of the best run clubs in England, and certainly in Europe.
Because they've lost over the last few years, they keep losing their managers, but it doesn't seem to make any difference at all. They've lost Martinez, they've lost they lost Brendan Rodgers, and I thought they might struggle this season having lost Rodgers, but it hasn't made a difference, and it's because of the way the club is set up, isn't it?
Yeah, because they don't want the manager to be this all-powerful figure who then, if you replace him, or if it doesn't work out, then you have to not just get rid of him, but like 10, 20 backroom staff. And that obviously sets the whole club back a couple of years, because that money that you need to pay off all these guys and signing new guys takes away from your budget, etc. And also there's a good chance that, you know, you'll have lots of players that the old regime wanted but the new doesn't. So I think they've been very, very smart in just making sure, yes, of course you can bring players in, yes, of course we will listen to your thoughts on the transfer market, but stuff that goes a little bit beyond that, you know, we do that. Don't worry about it. You just coach the team. And I think Laudrup, coming from a European perspective, obviously bought into that and has been brilliant in that system.
And Barry, what we were talking about Arsenal in terms of getting the right, you know, player to fit a club, Swansea get the right manager particularly well. They rarely make a bad managerial appointment, certainly in the last few years.
Yeah, and I thought Laudrup was going to be a bad appointment.
Me too, yeah.
I said at the start of the season, I thought their season would be a car crash under him, and that was, of many, many, many stupid things I've said in this podcast, that was probably proved to be the most stupid so far, unless something goes horribly wrong. But then it could be argued, if they lose against Bradford, fourth tier side in the League Cup final, that would be a car crash.
So I
will be proved right.
I get, yeah, just about, eventually. I'm getting the impression that Rafi and Jacob, you both think Swansea are going to win.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But you've got a sneaking feeling that Bradford might do it, Barry.
Look, it's win-win. Whoever wins that is going to, you know, it's going to be a good result. Obviously, the fans at the losing side will be crushed, but I don't think anyone else would begrudge either side victory. I'm not going to say I think Bradford will win, but I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised if they do win, and I think they're well-equipped to win.
Whatever happens, Barry, football will be the winner. And that's what matters to all of us, of course, around this table. Quick look ahead to the Premier League this weekend. The game that jumps out, of course, is the battle of the also-rans, Man City against Chelsea. A lot of people are making a lot of Man City 4, Leeds 0, as if somehow this heralds a turnaround, Rafi. I mean, does it? Or should we look at the Southampton game and go, Chelsea got a huge chance going there?
I don't think we should look at either game. I think City are favourites at home. I think Chelsea are capable to get a draw. You know, there's not a lot between the sides. City have the better squad, but they've been underperforming. Chelsea are more or less performing at the level that I expected them to be at. You know, they're a little bit inconsistent. City not perhaps the sort of force, the kind of almost physical presence that they used to have last year, where they always found a way to sort of win games either by some great ideas up front or just sort of steamrolling through weak opposition. They don't seem to have that inevitability around them. So I would still make City favourites. If Chelsea get a draw, it wouldn't be a surprise either. I don't think, as I said, there's that much between it, and it should be an interesting game because on the one hand you've got Benitez, who talks about Real Madrid being a really great club, and on the other you have Mancini, who said he's the best coach in England, so it should be really interesting.
Absolutely, a gourmet of a game. Absolutely. What jumps out at you from the weekend, Barry?
Well, I'm going to Norwich Everton.
Oh, you lucky man.
Yeah, it doesn't jump out at me particularly, but that's where I'll be. It'll be my first time in Carrow Road, and I'm looking forward to it. But my first time in Norwich, actually. Yeah.
Good place. Looking
forward to checking out the pedestrianisation of the city centre that Alan Partridge is.
You know, when you turn up there in this train station, there is a big poster of Alan Partridge's book.
Oh, is there?
Yeah. A bouncing back, is there?
Yeah.
That's useful to know.
So if I don't get a good game, I may drive to Dundee in my bare feet eating a Toblerone.
Absolutely. Do a Peter Rod and Wiggy, as it's known.
Yeah, what the standout? Well, you've QPR, Man United, and a lot of people seem to be saying, you know, QPR could get a result here, which I think they will get a result. They'll get hammered, but not the result some people are tipping them for. I think QPR are an absolutely terrible side, and I'm not even sure Harry Redknapp's that interested in keeping them up. I think he's just there to make a handy few quid.
He's got an excuse if he doesn't keep them up, that is for sure.
Oh, he always has an excuse.
With what went on before, hasn't he? Jacob, my club, Reading, are involved, not that I own them or anything like that, they're involved in a, I think, arguably the game of the weekend in terms of the table. I mean, Reading-Wigan is a gigantic game.
It is. And
sell it to me.
Sell it to you. It doesn't matter what's going to happen in the first 80 minutes. All that matters is what happens when Lafondre comes on and Reading are 2-0 down and then he scores his hat-trick or whatever, and they win 3-2 in the last minute, however long the stoppage time they play. Reading is a terrible side for about 80 minutes in games, but they're the only side that seems to be able to play for 10 minutes and come away with the points. And they've done this about a year, haven't they, under McDermott? You have to admire the spirit and the never-say-die attitude within that side. It's why they went up, and I think it's why they'll possibly stay up this season.
Yeah, the other thing to admire about Adam Lafondre is he doesn't really look like a footballer, which in this modern sort of world of homogeneity in sport, I think is a really good thing, Barry. He looks like someone who plays on a Sunday, doesn't he?
Yeah, but he talks like a footballer. He says, obviously, a hell of a lot. Obviously.
He doesn't sound like a footballer. He sounds more like a James Bond villain. You know, like Le Chiffre, Lafondre.
Yeah.
Lafondre's the number two.
Just been, producer Ben has just told me that I didn't know this, and I should have done that. Alfie, as we call him at Reading, his first name is actually Glenville. Glenville Adam Lafondre is the full name. And that is confirmed, is it, Ben? Just nod, yeah, that is confirmed. Any other footballers? I don't know where to go from there. Maybe we should finish there with the fact that Adam Lafondre's...
So what did you say Shaka Hislop was called before?
Neil. Yeah, Neil Hislop.
Neil Hislop.
So where did Shaka come from? I always thought, oh, God, what a cool name.
Yeah, no, he's Neil, in inverted commas, Shaka Hislop. And there's not really anywhere to go after that, is there? Anything to add there, Raf? You're just going to shake your head at me, aren't you?
I've got a story about Norwich. I can never go back to Norwich because when I was a student in 93, I went with a friend to see Bayern play and we were staying in a B&B. And I had this terrible gash down my shin from a game that they hadn't stitched up at the NHS. They just said, no, don't worry about it, you know, a bit of plaster and it'll be fine. And it basically broke open. And the next morning, the bed was full of blood. And I always wondered, you know, what were these guys thinking that we were doing?
Okay.
So I can never come back.
Okay, so, I was asking for a sort of cheery story to lift the mood. We've got a bed full of blood. Anything from you, Ben?
I've got a really cheery story. I was at St. George's, that very opulent England training centre yesterday, on a refereeing course Dermot Gallagher was taking, and of which there will be more anon on the site next week, I think. But anyway, I was talking to Dermot Gallagher, who's a very nice man, and I said, you know, did you actually enjoy being a referee? And he said, yeah, 22 years as a, you know, top referee. There was only one day
that I didn't enjoy. And that was the day he was officiating in the match in which Coventry City's David Boost famously broke his leg. He said, I went home, I wrote that one off, and I just thinking about it now, it was the only unpleasant day I had in 22 years. So there's a cheery, upbeat note with which we can end our today's pod.
The only thing I can offer is that a Coventry fan, I've completely forgotten about this, a Coventry fan, we're not going to get into the whole let's name our favourite football chants thing, but you may all know this, but I didn't know. When Peter Unlove and Terry Phelan used to play for Coventry, the fans used to sing, "We've got Unlove and Phelan." Which is possibly unbeatable, I think, in the world of football chants. Jacob, have you got anything to lift us just finally?
No.
Nothing at all? No injury news? No injury broken
news.
Legs?
Injury news. Got a bit of a sore calf at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
All of us leave them wanting more, Dave.
Yeah, I know. But wanting something. On that sensational bombshell of a note, a show that has pretty much gone downhill for the last 5 minutes comes to an end. All I can say is that things will be sparked back into life next week when, yes, he's back, James is here, you won't have to listen to me again for a long, long time, but don't worry about that. Thanks very much indeed, and to all the guests today. And Rafi's paper review, he's standing in for James this week. He'll be available on Friday online. That's all going to be done today. But thanks very much indeed to Barry, to Jacob, and to Rafi as well. And as I said, the great man is back on Monday and Thursday. And that's it from us for now.